Back in England, Russell married Dora in September. In November, his son John was born.
From that moment, my children were for many years my main interest in life.
If his political ideas had seemed radical earlier in life, Russell's moral views became notorious at this time. He and Dora had trouble renting a flat because of their scandalous reputations as free thinkers and free lovers, and they ended up buying a small house in London and a holiday cottage on the coast of Cornwall. His daughter Kate, born 2 years after John, remembered him in that cottage, surrounded by the exotic and delicate furnishings he had brought from China, always smoking his pipe.
In my memory, it was always sunny and always warm after April. The beauty of the Cornish coast is inextricably mixed in my memories with the ecstasy of watching two healthy children learning the joys of sea and rocks and sun and storm. I spent a great deal more time with them than is possible for most fathers.
In 1927, Dora and Russell opened an experimental school at which they applied their ideas of education. They did not anticipate that some of their students would be problem children, but they were.
Whatever the cause, many of the children were cruel and destructive. To let the children go free was to establish a reign of terror in which the strong kept the weak trembling and miserable. School is like the world. Only government can prevent brutal violence.
Despite disappointments, Russell retained his faith in logic. In its time, Russell's logic constituted an immense step forward. Even after the later work of Kurt Gödel, Russell has had great importance for work with computers, mathematical teaching, linguistics, and philosophy. It was in philosophy that Russell followed up his early work in mathematical theory.
After 1910, I'd done all that I'd intended to do as regards pure mathematics. I began to think about the physical world, and I was led to new applications of Occam's razor.
Again, he tried to diminish the number of assumptions required to interpret knowledge. He agreed with Descartes that the only immediately certain matters of fact are the states of mind which every individual is aware of within his consciousness. The only other certainties are the self-evident truths of logic and mathematics, and what can be deduced from them. This leaves in doubt the existence of the material world, the past, and God. Descartes thought he could prove the existence of God.
God may be defined as the possessor of all perfections. Existence is a perfection. That which exists is more perfect than that which does not. Therefore, God must exist.
You can consider the proposition, unicorns exist, and see that it is false. It is nonsense. When you say unicorns exist, you are not saying anything about any individual things. Existence propositions do not say anything about the actual individual, but about the class or function.
Russell undermined the traditional arguments for the existence of God, and he stridently opposed organized religion.
I think all the great religions of the world, Buddhism, Hinduism, Christianity, Islam, and communism, both untrue and harmful. It is evident, as a matter of logic, that since they disagree, not more than one of them can be true.
Russell was hostile to religion because it was logically defective, but he objected to it on moral grounds as well. He particularly disliked Christianity.
There is one very serious defect, to my mind, in Christ's moral character, and that is that he believed in hell. In the Gospels, one finds repeatedly a vindictive fury against those people who would not listen to his preaching. The doctrine that hellfire is a punishment for sin is a doctrine of cruelty.
Russell also rejected the kind of behavior he thought religion encouraged.
The whole conception of God is derived from the ancient Oriental despotisms. It is a conception quite unworthy of free men. When you hear people in church debasing themselves and saying that they are miserable sinners and all the rest of it, it seems contemptible, not worthy of self-respecting human beings.
At length, recalling myself, and in an all lowly and devout wise here, casting my soul and body prostrate before the dreadful throne of his justice, I acknowledge and confess, and I yield myself a most miserable, wretched sinner, guilty of that death and passion which Christ once suffered for me upon the tormenting cross. But turning myself to the throne of his infinite mercy, and with all my might and force, from the very bowels of my heart, detesting the iniquities of my former past life.
Organized religion of his youth, the source of most easily avoidable persecution and cruelty. He was one of a generation of libertarian thinkers who did for the Victorian age what Voltaire and the men of the French Enlightenment had done for the 17th century, with its tradition of religious savagery and intolerance. Together with contemporaries like H.G. Wells and George Bernard Shaw, Russell ridiculed the pieties of marriage and sexual conduct. Russell's libertarian ideas about sexual morality led him into serious trouble in 1940 when he was appointed to be professor of philosophy at the City College of New York. Bishop Manning of the Episcopal Church wrote to the press,
"What is to be said of colleges and universities which hold up before our youth as a responsible teacher of philosophy a man who is a recognized propagandist against both religion and morality, and who specifically defends adultery?"
Amid a general public uproar, Mrs. Jean Kay of Brooklyn sued the city, demanding that Russell's appointment be canceled. Her lawyer expressed her views in court.
"His works are lecherous, libidinous, lustful, venerous, erotomaniac, aphrodisiac, irreverent, narrow-minded, untruthful, and bereft of moral fiber."
"I by no means believe that all that is best in human life is connected with sex. The doctrine that I wish to preach is not one of license. It involves self-control applied more to abstaining from interference with the freedom of others than to restraining one's own freedom."
Russell never forgot his unmarried Aunt Agatha, who had padded through his grandmother's house, always silent, in velvet slippers.
"She remained unmarried, having once become engaged to a curate, and suffered from insane delusions during their engagement, which led to its being broken off. She was a victim of my grandmother's virtue. If she had not been taught that sex was wicked, she might have been happy, successful, and able."
Russell objected to conventional doctrines because they were unreasonable and insulting to the intelligence of the rational man, and they were cruel. Even the conventions of love were cruel. Loneliness might be better.
"Underlying all occupations and all pleasures I have felt since early youth is the pain of solitude. I have escaped it most nearly in moments of love. Yet even there I found that the escape depended partly upon illusion. My most profound feelings have remained always solitary and have found in human things no companionship. The sea, the stars, the night wind in waste places mean more to me than even the human beings I love best. I am conscious that human affection is to me at bottom an attempt to escape from the vain search for God."
Always committed to rationality, Russell objected to some of the work of his contemporaries. He ultimately rejected the theories of men he admired, who were even friends. Men like G.E. Moore and Ludwig Wittgenstein.
There is a linguistic doctrine which maintains that the language of daily life, with words used in their ordinary meaning, suffices for philosophy. To discuss endlessly what silly people mean when they say silly things may be amusing, but can hardly be important.
He respected not common sense, which he called naive realism, but science. Physical science, he thought, showed that the common sense view of the world was simply false.
We think that stones are hard, but the observer, when he seems to himself to be observing a stone, is really, if physics is to be believed, observing the effects of the stone upon himself. Naive realism leads to physics, and physics, if true, shows that naive realism is false. Therefore, naive realism, if true, is false. Therefore, it is false.
That logical flourish at the end is characteristic. It shows Russell's confidence in the power of abstract theoretical reason to overthrow the most ancient and fundamental of human convictions.
The observer is really observing the effects of the stone upon himself.
The apparent conflict between science and common sense didn't bother Russell. He was undisturbed by logical contradictions. His tendency to accept contradictions had resulted in part from one of the most puzzling and obstructive aspects of his work on Principia Mathematica.
It seemed to me that a class sometimes is and sometimes is not a member of itself. Classes that are not members of themselves, it seemed, must form a class. If this class is a member of itself, it must possess the defining property of the class, which is to be not a member of itself. If it is not a member of itself, it must not possess the defining property of the class, and therefore must be a member of itself. Thus each alternative leads to its opposite, and there is a contradiction.
Russell solved this problem with his theory of types. Its central idea was that all assertions referring to themselves are logically improper or senseless.
What I am now saying is false.
All generalizations are false.
Statements that are grammatically correct can be logically nonsensical.
What I am now saying is false.
All generalizations are false.
Philosophers became self-conscious about language. Some of them, the logical positivists, tried to discover a criterion of meaning. Philosopher Gilbert Ryle traced the sequence of events in these words.
Russell, in his enquiries into the logical principles underlying mathematics, found that he could not help constructing statements which were true only on condition that they were false, and false only on condition that they were true. There was a major leak in the dry dock which he had built for mathematics. Russell found a patch for the leak. Some forms of words with the vocabulary and constructions of statements are neither true nor false, but nonsensical for logical reasons. So logic is concerned with what can or cannot be significantly said.
Russell's theory of descriptions takes the idea that logic underlies grammar in a hidden way a step further. The theory of descriptions began when Russell was trying to account for denoting phrases. Russell thought a denoting phrase, a genuine name, had to denote some real thing to have meaning. For instance, there is no such person as the present King of France.
Either the present King of France is bald, or the present King of France is not bald must be true. Yet, if we enumerated the things that are bald and then the things that are not bald, we should not find the present King of France in either list. Hegelians, who love a synthesis, will probably conclude that he wears a wig.
Russell would say that the present King of France is not really a denoting phrase at all, even though it may appear in a spoken sentence. It is false to say that the present King of France is bald, and it is also false to say that the present King of France is not bald.
You could say that unicorns exist, but it would be nonsense.
The philosopher Ramsey called the theory of descriptions a paradigm of philosophy because it reveals the logical complications of our everyday discourse. Gilbert Ryle wrote,
"Such expressions can be reformulated, And for philosophy, they must be reformulated into expressions of which the syntactical form is proper to the facts recorded.
Throughout his career, Russell wanted philosophy to be as close as possible to science, to be like science, even to be a part of science. In 1945, he expressed a view he had held as early as 1914.
Modern analytical empiricism is able, in regard to certain problems, to achieve definite answers which have the quality of science rather than of philosophy. It has the advantage of being able to tackle its problems one at a time.
Philosopher Morton White summed up the persisting style of Russell's work.
He has thought of philosophy as essentially reconstructive in nature, as obliged to rebuild mathematics, physics, and common sense upon a firmer foundation, or at least one that dispenses with questionable assumptions and obscure entities. Russell's conception of analysis makes philosophy an integral part of science itself.
Russell lived long enough to see his work go out of fashion. In 1948, he published his last major philosophical book, Human Knowledge. It was received with respectful indifference.
I would not now recommend anybody to take up philosophy. It has descended into triviality.
Russell's attention turned once again to the wider world. He developed a passion for justice. Beatrice Webb, a friend who had known him well.
He is a good hater, almost cruel in his desire to see cruelty revenged.
This idea of weapons of mass extermination is utterly and absolutely horrible. And it's a thing which no man with one spark of humanity can tolerate. And I will not pretend to obey a government which is organizing the massacre of the whole of mankind. We cannot obey these murderers. Wicked and abominable. They are the wickedest people that ever lived in the history of man, and it is our duty to do what we can.
For the last 20 years of his life, he was preoccupied with the danger of atomic war. Immediately after the bombing of Hiroshima, Russell wanted America, the only nation with atomic weapons, to insist on nuclear disarmament, even if it cost one or two brief wars. Russell was imprisoned in 1961 during his disarmament campaign. He was 90 years old. Never afraid to take an unpopular stand, Russell believed that the United States was a greater threat to world peace than Russia after the Cuban Missile Crisis. His belief was reinforced by the war in Vietnam. In 1963, he set up his own peace foundation. And 3 years later, he convened an international war crimes tribunal to judge America's war in Vietnam. Only Stockholm would allow the sometimes biased tribunal to meet. Just a week before he died, in 1970, he was still taking unpopular public stands.
The aggression committed by Israel must be condemned. Not only because no state has the right to annex foreign territory, but because every expansion is also an experiment to discover how much more aggression the world will tolerate.
Russell wrote his own obituary 30 years too early. This is what he said about himself.
In his youth, he did work of importance in mathematical logic, but his eccentric attitude during the First World War revealed a lack of balanced judgment which increasingly infected his later writings. His historical writings, by their style and their wit, conceal from careless readers the superficiality of the antiquated rationalism which he professed to the end. His life, for all its waywardness, had a certain anachronistic consistency. His principles were curious, but such as they were, they governed his actions.
Thou shalt not follow a multitude to do evil.
He is conscientious, public-spirited, and likes excitement. So I suppose he will always be popping out of his cloister into the world.
He is a charming man.
But after all, what did he mean?
His pointed ears.
He must be unbalanced.
A lack of balanced judgment.
Thou shalt not follow a multitude to do evil.
He talked in a harsh yet rather mincing voice, endlessly, endlessly, always with a strong mentality working, always interesting, and yet always known, everything he said known beforehand.
I have throughout my philosophical career had only one constant preoccupation, to discover how much we can be said to know and with what degree of certainty or doubtfulness.
Russell's conception of analysis makes philosophy an integral part of science itself.
His words
who is a
lecherous,
propagandist,
libidinous,
both religion and morality, and who specifically defends
erotomaniac, and bereft of moral fiber.
The doctrine that I wish to preach is not one of license.
To do evil.
An intellectual aristocrat.
To discuss endlessly what silly people mean when they say silly things may be amusing, but can hardly be important.
A technical logician.
Naive realism leads to physics, and physics, if true, shows that naive realism is false. Therefore, naive realism, if true, is false. Therefore, it is false.
Unafraid of logical contradiction.
Either the present king of France is bald, or the present king of France is not bald, must be true. Yet, if we enumerated the things that are bald, and then the things that are not bald, we should not find the present king of France in either list. Hegelians, who love a synthesis, will probably conclude that he wears a wig.
He was devoted to reason. He hated human suffering.
There is one very serious defect, to my mind, in Christ's moral character, and that is that he believed in hell.
A dry and passionate man.
We cannot obey these murderers. They are wicked and abominable. They are the wickedest people that ever lived in the history of man, and it is our duty to do what we can.
Thou shalt not follow.
His principles were curious, but such as they were, they governed his actions.
Russell's life coincides with an era in the history of philosophy that detached itself rather neatly and can be defined in any of three almost equivalent ways. Philosophy, since John Stuart Mill, or the past 100 years in philosophy, or, most significantly, the age of Russell. In the age of Russell, philosophy itself has gone the way that each of us has gone, who was lured to philosophy by Russell's logic.
Why should I admit these things if they can't be proved?
A Question of Place. Bertrand Russell. A Portrait in Sound. You heard John Houseman in the title role. The narrator was Tommy Grimes. Also heard were Leela Blake, Michael Cockerham, Russell Horton, Donald Madden, Joe Mahar, and John Tillinger. Their performances were directed by Daniel Freudenberger. The program was cast by Bonnie Timmerman. Bertrand Russell, A Portrait in Sound, was scripted by Mary Lou Finnegan and Carol Mulmey. Principal Consultant, Anthony Quinton. The program was produced by Mary Lou Finnegan. Technical Director, John Whitoff. Production Assistants, Kathy Klukas and Alex Eldridge. A Question of Place. Sound Portraits of 20th Century Humanists is made possible with a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional funds from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is from the first volume of the autobiography of Bertrand Russell, from the prologue called What I Have Lived For. Three passions, simple but ungovernably strong, have ruled my life: the longing for love, the search for wisdom, and unbearable pity for the suffering of mankind. These passions, like great winds, have blown me hither and thither in a wayward course over a deep ocean of anguish, reaching to the very verge of despair. I have sought love, first, because it brings ecstasy, ecstasy so great that I would often have sacrificed all the rest of my life for a few hours of this joy. I have sought it next because it relieves loneliness, the terrible loneliness in which one shivering consciousness looks over the rim of the world into the cold, unfathomable, lifeless abyss. I have sought it finally because, in the union of love, I have seen in a mystic miniature the prefiguring vision of the heaven that saints and poets have imagined. This is what I sought, and though it might seem too good for human life, this is what, at last, I have found. With equal passion, I have sought knowledge. I have wished to understand the hearts of men. I have wished to know why the stars shine, and I have tried to apprehend the Pythagorean power by which number holds sway above the flow. A little of this, but not much, I have achieved. Love and knowledge, as far as they were possible, led upwards toward the heavens, but always pity brought me back to earth. Echoes of cries of pain reverberate in my heart. Children in famine, victims tortured by oppressors, helpless old people, a hated burden to their sons, and the whole world of loneliness, poverty, and pain make a mockery of what human life should be. I long to alleviate these evils, but I cannot, and I too suffer. This has been my life. I have found it worth living, and would gladly live it again if the chance were offered me. That was the autobiography of Bertrand Russell. Try that on a rainy day when you are lonely or a long way from home.
Writer Ellen Gilchrist with an excerpt from the speech she gave this past weekend during graduation ceremonies at the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas.